There are times during these podcasts when one ought to specify the actual date of the podcast. Today, as we record, is July 22nd. I say that because we're going to be talking about Egypt, and obviously things are rather dynamic in the most ancient of all nations. And what the situation will be a month from now, when this podcast will still be available, I am not sure. My guest is very well positioned to tell us a great deal about the present and the likely future situation in Egypt. He is Samuel Tadros, a native Egyptian who is on the staff of the Hudson Institute's Center for Religious Freedom in Washington. You were, of course, Samuel, educated in Egypt and then did graduate work in the United States. Is that right?
Yes, indeed.
And for some time, you have been much occupied in researching, as an historian and political scientist, the rise of and the undertakings of what broadly might be called Islamism and Islamist organizations. The major one, of course, in your country is the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, of course. The rise of Islamism is, of course, no new phenomena. Although the latest upheaval in Egypt in the past 2.5 years has allowed Islamism to occupy a position of power that it has not attained throughout its history. So it's been quite exciting times for anyone who's interested in Egyptian politics or in the future course of Islamism.
Let us try to define Islamism. Obviously, it's on the right, or it's fundamentalist, and there must be some contrast within the broad Islamic community. But exactly what does one mean by Islamism?
Islamism is a political ideology that claims to be the only political representation of Islam. Of course, its claims are, to say the least, claims, meaning that they should neither be taken or at face value or accepted. It's a modern movement. It's born out of a specific crisis that the Muslim world has faced. It is that crisis that the greatest historian of the Middle East, Bernard Lewis, has accurately described as what went wrong, meaning that discovering the backwardness of the Muslim world in front of Europe, starting with Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, Egyptians and other people in the Middle East began to discover that their long-held notions about their superiority to Christendom were no longer true, that the West has advanced beyond anything that they could imagine, and that they were finally facing this West not only as a superior other in terms of intellectual, technological development, but also in the form of occupation and imperialism. So as a result, Islamism is born as an ideology attempting to explain what went wrong in the Muslim history by claiming that Muslims were great in the past, created a great civilization, and that a return to this purer original form of Islam would mean a return of the Muslims to their dominant place in world politics, or to their superior position once again.
Now, how does one differentiate, or does one not differentiate, from Islamism such traditions, such movements, such historical realities as Wahhabism and Salafism? And how does one relate all of this to the different divisions within Muslim religion? I have in mind the main division of Sunni and Shia. One thinks of the many other Islamic religious movements or religious communities which are a minority and are breakaway from yet the major Shiite or Sunni tradition. One such would be the Alawites, who control Syria, though they are a minority. It's not a simple singular movement, Islamism. It seems to be reflective of perhaps even deep differences within what is sometimes called the Ummah, that is, the total Islamic community.
Naturally, Islamism as a political ideology, there are many variants between it. Wahhabism started as a movement that is not concerned with modernity at all, isolated in its in the peninsula, in the Arabian Peninsula. It did not encounter the West in the form of the superior technological.
Well, it starts in the 18th century, as I remember.
Yeah, and at the time when the Arabian Peninsula was completely isolated from the rest of the world, Wahhabism is a reform movement within Islam that aims to purify the religion from the various rituals that grew up and traditions that are viewed as heterodox and that had been accumulated throughout the centuries. Of course, Wahhabism today is something very different because it has dominated the state and it has grown in contact with the world. But in its original form, Wahhabism was not part of the Islamist discourse. Islamism, in a sense, is divided into two main groupings or two main ideologies. That's Salafism and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood's brilliance of its founder, Hassan al-Banna, is his reliance on modern organization methods, i.e. the fascist emerging movements in Europe at the time in the 20s and 30s, in building his mass movement. So unlike all other forms of Islamist politics, the Brotherhood variant is extremely organized, built on a very clear structure and organization of obedience of a leader and his followers. This is not the same in other variants of Islamism, which is Salafism, which is much more a traditional discourse that is linked with the Brotherhood's modern notions, but is very much seeking or has its links with various forms in Islamic history, especially the Hanbali school of Islamic jurisprudence.
Let us be very clear about the rise and now the more recent fall and possible return of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, particularly. Though it was outlawed for many years, it continued to flourish with its own constituency. And then, rather suddenly, it emerges as the government of Egypt, though that that particular government lasted for just about 1 year. How does one explain the recent rise and fall of the Brotherhood?
The rise of the Brotherhood is, in a sense, expected. In the absence of any other coherent discourse in the country, Islamism, especially its Brotherhood variant, is the dominating narrative. It makes sense for someone to vote for the Brotherhood in a way that's not true of the other competing narratives, whether they are the liberal variant, as rare as that may be in the country, or the socialist one. So the Brotherhood has behind it a long history of organization that has built quite an impressive network, that has provided services in the country, that has built patron-client relations with a constituency, but that has also dominated the public sphere and the realm of ideas. I mean, Google any word concept in Arabic on YouTube, trying to find videos about it, whether it's entrepreneurship, whether it's technology, whatever the term may be. And the first number of hits you get are automatically Islamist preachers commenting on those concepts. Islamists have really dominated the ideological sphere in the country. The fall of the Brotherhood, however, is another interesting story.
But before we come to the fall of the Brotherhood, let's come to the rise, that is, the governmental rise of the Brotherhood. After all, when the revolution that unseated the long-running government in Egypt occurred in Tahrir Square as the focus of public protest, the government that arose was essentially dominated by the military, and then ran for about a year or a year and a half until it fell to a new government. To be sure, there was an intervening election of sorts, and that new government was the Brotherhood government. Why did the intervening government fail? And how did the Brotherhood finally seize power? And indeed, how did it win an election?
It didn't fail in the sense that it was a temporary government in the first place. The military took over power after the fall of Mubarak with the plan of holding elections at a date in the future. And once the elections were held, whether it was the parliamentary elections for the lower chamber of parliament, the Islamists won with 72%. The higher chamber of parliament, 83%. Then the Egyptian presidency, 51%. So at every elections that were held in Egypt, the Islamists have dominated those elections. And two things have been working for them. The first is that they have this very strong organization that has built a supportive network throughout the country and not only in a square or in a city. And the fact that there is no one really competing with them. They are the dominating narrative. They knock on open doors when they campaign in those various villages of Egypt.
But look, if they've been getting majorities in various elections, what was the legitimacy of the undertaking to unseat them? To be sure, it was the military who unseated them, having originally allowed the election that elected them to proceed. But is there some deep injustice that has been done to President Morsi and to the Brotherhood itself?
Well, if you hear the Brotherhood's members and supporters of the Brotherhood, they definitely make a strong case. Mohamed Morsi was the democratically elected president of Egypt.
Yes, that's what they're saying, of course.
And he was unseated by a military coup. The fact that the military coup had some popular support does not mean that it wasn't a military coup. It was. There's no escaping that. And in the Islamist argument is that President Morsi was never handed a good hand in the game. He was handed an economy that was already falling. He was handed state institutions that were not cooperative, that were intent on making him fail. On the other hand, of course, you have to realize that the Islamists have completely failed in governance. They have shown a complete incompetence in managing the basic governance of the country. They had no experience in it. As Edmund Burke remarked on people similar to them, maybe 200 years ago at the time of the French Revolution, these are people that had never seen the state in a picture, let alone an opportunity to run one.
So, as I try to examine the recent history, one thing that seems to have been of central significance, so I think it's not fully appreciated in the non-Egyptian Western world, is that the Morsi government had an appointed special body to draw up a new constitution, and that new constitution, as put forward, turned out to be rather repressive of non-Islamist movements, and in general seemed to be a restoration of a kind of theocracy disguised as a secular government. And apparently this was very hard on, or it would have been very hard on ordinary people, and they began to catch on to that fact. Is that a fair summary, if a simple one?
The constitutional drafting body was chosen before President Morsi assumed power, so it was basically composed by the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated parliament in April, 2 months before his assumption of the presidency. The body was supposed to be inclusive of all Egyptians. The Brotherhood promised that everyone would have a stake, would have a say in the country's future. But as you've commented, the constitutional process is an indication of the Brotherhood's year in power in terms of were not inclusive at all. They excluded everyone else from decision making. At the end of the day, they passed a constitutional draft that was extremely problematic after most of Egypt's institutions, i.e. the Coptic Church, Al-Azhar, the various state institutions, all the oppositions, walked out of that parliament, of the constitutional drafting process. And, of course, they were able to pass it in a popular referendum. It did receive 64% of the vote, but it showed a country that was extremely divided. It had one of the lowest participation rates in any elections or referendum held in Egypt. So definitely this constitution, which enshrined a religious-dominated, a Sunni Islamic religious-dominated umbrella above Egypt was certainly one of the reasons why many seculars, all of the seculars, felt extremely threatened by the idea of the Brotherhood continuing in power.
Now, who are the seculars of, or the secularists of whom you speak? What is the actual profile of Egypt in terms of religio-political commitments and causes? We know that the Muslim Brotherhood is there and has a strong following. Who truly opposes it, and what's the following of the opposition?
The Brotherhood's opposition basically gathered everyone else in Egypt, and it's an amalgam of people that wouldn't work together in any other circumstances. So on the one hand, you have the Nur Party, this radical Islamist party, the radical Salafi party, and it's much more extreme in terms of its views than the Brotherhood, but it clashed with the Brotherhood in terms of organizational power grab by the movement. So you had the Salafis on board in that military coup against them. At the same time, you had what is termed the remnants of the old regime, and that's the Mubarak regime, of course, meaning those traditional families that have always dominated the Egyptian countryside through a patron-client relationship, and that felt threatened by the Brotherhood, realizing that a Brotherhood dominated Egypt would mean that they would be excluded from power, would completely end as the dominant families of the countries. At the third side, you had obviously the Christians, who by the very nature of being Christian felt threatened by the Islamist project that would make them nothing more than second-class citizens.
When you speak of Christians, the reference is basically to the Coptic Church.
Yes, yes, true.
Which numbers how many in the Egyptian population?
We don't have very reliable figures. The Egyptian government gives us a number of 6%, while Copts claim much higher numbers. The State Department gives us a figure of about 9%. So you have a variety of figures there, but in a population of 85 million, even if you go with the lowest estimate of 6%, we're still talking about 5, 6 million individuals there.
It is appropriate to note at this moment in our conversation that you are a Coptic Christian.
Yes. And the other, besides those three groups, besides the remnants of the old regime, the Christians and the Salafis, you also have the business community that felt that the Brotherhood was extremely incompetent in governing the country. You also had leftists, Trotskyite movements, other forms of leftism that are a bit popular in Egypt, people who follow the dreams of Arab nationalism as embodied by Gamal Abdel Nasser and call themselves Nasserites. You had the few liberals out there, genuine liberals out there. So it was basically an amalgam of everyone who was not a member of the Muslim Brotherhood joining in this coalition with the military in order to bring the Brotherhood down.
Is there any way to estimate the comparative percentages? Is the amalgam, as you call it, of groups opposed to the Morsi regime and really to the dominance by the Muslim Brotherhood, is it in majority status, or is the loyalty to Islamism and to the Brotherhood essentially the majority position among the Egyptian population in total?
It's impossible to estimate because no elections were held in order to see whether people support the removal of President Morsi or not. Of course, there has been a lot of public discontent against the government of President Morsi.
Accumulated in just 1 year.
Yes, significant demonstrations that have been massive, probably the largest in Egyptian history, on the 30th of June. So you've had a showing of public discontent. However, we've not had elections in order to judge what the exact percentages are of each camp. On the other hand, we notice a geographical division inside the country in terms of views of the Brotherhood and the Morsi government. The discontent against the president has been mainly focused in Egypt's two largest cities, Cairo and Alexandria. Cairo is, of course, a city of a minimum of 17 million individuals. So it is at least 20% of the population of the country. And with Alexandria, that's a significant population. plus this the Delta region to the north of Cairo. So that this is where the anger against the Brotherhood has mainly manifested itself. We notice in the south of the country, south between Cairo and Aswan to the Sudan border, there is basically an acceptance or a support of the Brotherhood. So there is a form of geographical division in the country between those supporting the president and those against him.
So what's the nature of the present regime? We know the names, but not much about the people. The president, essentially appointed by the military, is Adli Mansour. The prime minister, Hazem el-Beldawi. And then Mohammed al-Baradi, who had significant international prominence with regard to nuclear issues, and then came back to Egypt, looking forward to rising to the top, was ready to take the position as prime minister, or as president, I'm not sure, but he couldn't pull it off. He now emerges as vice president, but considers himself in some part in opposition to the president. I don't understand.
The real power in the country, of course, there's no doubt, is the military. They're calling the shots. They're the ones managing everything. They're
well, the power... Power, as we know, flows from the barrel of a gun.
Definitely. I mean, there's no doubt that today or in 10 years' time, if any Egyptian president decides to take a controversial decision, ask the Minister of Interior to implement it, he run back to the military asking if they approve it or not. Everyone understands now where the balance of power is. So the military is definitely there behind the scenes calling the shots. Of course, they're also aware that they don't want to appear at the forefront of the whole scene in Egypt. Partly this is due to international pressure. They don't want to make it a military coup. They're well aware that this might affect their relationship with the U.S. and the ability of the U.S. to provide funding and weapons to them. So they don't want to make this a coup. They want to have this civilian facade in front of them as appearing in front of the international community. The president is a technocrat in terms of he's a judge that has served as Egypt's head of the Supreme Court for 2 days before being appointed president. The previous head of the Supreme Court had to retire. So the man, in a sense, rose suddenly in 2 days to be head of Egypt's Supreme Court and then to be Egypt's interim president.
Let me put to you a number of rather quick questions concerning matters of immediate concern. The first one is, how stable is the present situation, or might the Brotherhood come back to power? The second is, and I'm going to list a number of them, what is the economic status of Egypt generally? Is it still, in fact, in considerable economic misery with vast unemployment and with poverty at very high levels, as I read is the case? Third, what will the consequence of the Egyptian revolution and counter-revolution and renewed revolution, what will the significance of all of that be for the rest of the Middle East Arab world? And last in this string of questions, you could weave them all together, is how does this affect the frozen peace between Egypt and Israel, and more broadly, how does the present Egyptian situation affect the ultimate prospect for stabilization of the role of Israel in relation to the rest of the Arab world that surrounds it? loaded your plate rather heavily, and we have about 10 minutes to discuss these matters.
Sure. The situation has not still stabilized in Egypt. The military's decision to move the tanks was a last-minute decision, meaning that they really didn't have a plan on how to deal with the situation with the aftermath of the removal of President Morsi. On the other hand, the Brotherhood doesn't have a game plan. Their plan so far seems to be to offer themselves as martyrs, as they call it, in the hope that this would create a Chavez-like scenario during the military coup against him in 2002, where the people would bring back the president to power. Of course, this is extremely unlikely. It has no possibility of occurring. The Brotherhood will not return to power anytime soon in Egypt. In fact, it is looking at the probability, the possibility of being excluded from the political scene for some time, of being targeted specifically, its members arrested, its leadership perhaps tried for a variety of accused crimes. So the Brotherhood is looking at the possibility of total exclusion and not at any realistic scenario of returning to power. The long-term prospects of this are, of course, very problematic. Islamists are now being given the message that while they accepted to participate in the democratic process is now being taken away from them, leaving them with one reasonable argument, and that's it's you have to go through the bullets and not the ballots. So return of jihadi narratives. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda now, is basically sending the message to Islamists in Egypt, I told you so. It's not through the ballot box that you can reach the Islamist dream. It's only through jihad and our way. So there is a prospect in the Egypt's future where we see a return to violent jihadism, terrorist attacks, a form of insurgency, especially in the south or in the Sinai Peninsula. Concerning the economic situation of the country, the economic situation remains very problematic. There have been a number of billions of dollars being offered by Gulf states, about 12 billion in total, that are being offered by the Gulf states in order to help Egypt. That's Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. The three countries hold very strong anti-brotherhood feelings and would like to support a government that's against the brotherhood. Of course, this would mean this money would perform a necessary task of saving the Egyptian economy from its current free fall, but it's not a long-term solution. Egypt's economic woes are structural ones, and unless an Egyptian government is confident enough in having the popular support in order to undertake very painful economic reforms, the economic situation is likely to continue to deteriorate in the future. The effect on the whole Middle East, Bashar is particularly happy in Syria. The Muslim Brotherhood regime had increased the rhetoric against Syria, had helped and allowed Egyptians to go to fight with the various Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Syria in order to defeat the Bashar regime. So the Syrian regime is extremely happy. Those traditional monarchies that are extremely against the Brotherhood, that don't like the Brotherhood at all, are again extremely happy, whether we're talking the Saudis or the people at the Emirates, and the Jordanian monarch, who has given very strong statements against the Brotherhood, is facing a Brotherhood party inside his own country, and was the first foreign leader to visit Egypt's interim president to show support for this coup in Cairo. So the region of powers that are against the Brotherhood are extremely happy. The region of powers that were for the Brotherhood, especially Turkey and the Tunisian Brotherhood branch, the Nahda Party, are, of course, finding the situation extremely problematic, as well as Qatar, that had provided a lot of the funding for the Brotherhood's in terms of loans to Egypt, and that is thus viewed as supportive of the Brotherhood and will likely face repercussions for that position. Israel is, of course, I would call, should be happy in terms of realizing that the Islamists were never likely to be friends of Israel, though they maintained lip service to Egypt's international agreements and peace commitments. There is no doubt that the Brotherhood on the long term would have sought to remove those treaties in some form or another, perhaps by popular referendum.
But you know, I note the implication there is that a more liberal government backed by a liberal constituency in Egypt will make for better relations and continued peace with Israel. But I note this, you published an article way back in 2009 titled, "Why Are Egypt's Liberals Anti-Semitic?"
Exactly.
Why are they?
Because it's tough to say it as an Egyptian liberal myself, but there is no liberalism in Egypt. A liberalism that is completely committed to anti-Semitic discourse is not really liberal in the first place. Egypt's liberalism has historical problems from being born inside of the state and not anything like the European experiment of an independent bourgeoisie. It has always had a love-hate relationship with the West, viewing it as both the source of inspiration and of modernity, and at the same time as the hated occupier. It has very problematic discourses in its history that have stopped any possibility of it becoming a genuine liberalism. Many of the people referred to as liberals in Egypt are not really liberal in any form or shape. A better term perhaps might be non-Islamist. There are a group of people that for whatever reasons are against the Islamist project, but they're not genuine liberals in any form or shape.
Can you conceive a movement that will liberalize not merely the politics of the Middle East and of Egypt, but that will liberalize the theology and the practice of Islam itself, in whether in Sunni or Shiite Islam, for Egypt particularly in the Sunni tradition? Can the Muslim faith be somehow liberalized to abandon its aspirations, sometimes very strongly voiced, for full dominance of the world? And can it at the same time abandon its anti-Semitism? Can it, in fact, or is it in fact going through some transformation in the modernizing direction, or will it remain an insistent reinforcement of and reassertion of old verities, old truths, old hatreds, old exclusions?
In a sense, there are two separate questions here, whether there can be liberalism as a competitor to Islamism and whether there can be liberalism inside of Islam. In the first instance, liberalism cannot be born without any actual groundwork existing. To say the least, the state of knowledge of liberal discourse in the Arab world is very minimal. Unless you are Westernly educated, as I was fortunate to be, you do not have access to the basic tenets, the basic canon of Western civilization that has created all this discourse of democracy and liberalism. It's sad for an Arab to say that a civilization that has kept for the world the works of Plato and Aristotle, you cannot find Plato in Arabic today in the streets of Cairo. You cannot find Aristotle, you cannot find those basic canons of Western civilization. People, of course, won't treat Thomas Jefferson and become Democrats tomorrow, but if a whole country has never read any of those works, it's no surprise that there is no actual liberal discourse in that country.
Samuel, a last question, time being rather short, but this is very important, and I should have given it more attention in our conversation, which has been inevitably on the brief side. And this relates to your own religious community, the Coptic Church of Egypt, which has suffered considerably at the hands of the Brotherhood, including exterminations of some groups. Some 50 in one particular church were assassinated or were killed on one day. There's been something of a Coptic movement out of Egypt, I gather, in response to very hard times. Where does that all stand?
Certainly the Christians of Egypt have suffered under the Brotherhood regime, both on the national level and the local level. On the national level, you had a constitution that discriminated against them, created a second-class citizenship for them. You had regulations that limited their ability to build churches. You had all forms of government interference. You had attacks happening against Christians that went automatically unpunished, including a very significant attack on the very headquarters of the Coptic Church at the heart of Cairo.
And it should be noted, should it not, that in likely population numbers, the Copts may compose something as much as 10% of the total Egyptian population.
Yes, and the government of the Mohamed Morsi was very clear that it was a government of Egypt's Muslims and not of Egypt's Christians. On the other hand, on the local level, that's perhaps more problematic, where people, the level of intolerance in society has significantly increased. So if you might be able to change the feelings on top. You might be able to change a law or two to make things better for Christians. But the local hatreds, the neighbors attacking their Christian neighbors, burning their churches, that's something that's extremely hard to change. The position that the Coptic Church took in support of the military coup, the very visible support that the Coptic Pope gave to this military coup, is likely to have repercussions on the Copt. The Islamists have a very strong incitement currently against Christians, accusing them of being the real power behind this coup. There have been a number of attacks against Christians as a result of them being blamed for things going in Egypt. You've had the killing of a Coptic priest in the Sinai, the burning of a number of Christian homes and killing a couple of Christians in the south of Egypt, in Menya and Luxor, and this is likely to continue with us in the future.
That's what happens when you drive out all the Jews.
Definitely. There's a saying that Brotherhood demonstrators used to say in the 1940s in their demonstrations in support of the Palestinians. Today is Saturday. Tomorrow is Sunday, O Christians. It's basically the message that today we will deal with the Jews, but the day will come for you in the future, Christians.
Yeah. Huh. Samuel Tadros, thank you so much. A very illuminating report on the situation in Egypt. And I do very much appreciate your joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.